I don't want that to happen again. This time, if she's got her hand in it, I want to nail her. Bob said, Okay, then one of the first things we want to do is not talk like that. We're doing an investigation, not carrying out a vendetta. You and Ray and me might know that we're trying to nail her, but that can't go on the record. We're looking into what we think might be a crime, a murder, and guess what? Senator Grant pops up, much to our surprise. No way, no how did we frame her. Never even thought about it. Of course not, Lucas said. To Ray, you did say he was smarter than he looks. I also said that wouldn't be hard, Ray said. Bob and Ray went to check out their rooms down the hall from Lucas to wash their faces and use the bathrooms. 15 minutes later, they were back, talking about how to proceed. They worried about the Ford truck. It was a key piece of evidence, but not yet a very good one. They had to combine the truck with other evidence if they wanted to get any of it in front of a jury, and they had to do it quickly. Bob said, The problem with letting it go is if Ritter takes it out and deliberately smacks it into another car or scrapes a bridge abutment, there goes the evidence. If he managed to do it right, he wouldn't even have to pay for it. His insurance would cover it. Yeah, I know, but what are we gonna do? Lucas asked. How about if we got your West Virginia cop over there to document it, sometime when Ritter isn't around, Ray suggested. We'd at least have a record of the damage, and somebody official who could testify to it. That might be something, Lucas said. Be nice if we could do it somewhere besides his apartment complex. Even if he's not home, somebody could see us and mention it to him. They talked about how that might work and then let it go. They'd make some kind of decision the next day. Is there any possibility that Smalls could prod Grant? Ray asked. You say he's already pissing on her. What if he made some kind of statement that hinted he thought she'd try to assassinate him and wound up murdering Whitehead? That could drive her underground, Lucas said. She might freeze out everyone, tell them all to disappear. What we need to do is get her worried, get her moving around, get her trying to fix things, get her boys more out in the open. Bob, I don't think we should mess with either Parrish or Grant. Not yet. For our sake. Listen, we're messing with the U.S. Senate here. If that became public, we could lose our jobs. Lucas, but she's nuts. We need to get at her. Bob nodded. Yeah, we do, but we have to come at it from another direction. We have to be protecting the Senate. Somebody tried to off Smalls, right? An assassination attempt. We try to find the assassins. That takes us to Ritter and Heracles takes us to Parrish, and Parrish works for Grant. We take that to the Attorney General, maybe get a look in from the FBI. Ray and Lucas looked at each other, and Lucas said, He's right, of course. Ray nodded. He might be right, but where do we go with that? Lucas mentioned that he and Smalls shared a theory about how Smalls's Cadillac could have been hit but show no signs of anything other than impacts with trees. They'd have hung a grid of tree trunks off the side of the truck, like a Boy Scout raft, Bob said. So? We know Ritter lives back here in the Washington area, and his accomplices, whoever they are, another guy was seen in the truck, probably live here, too, working for Heracles. After they ran Smalls off the road, they'd have wanted to get those tree trunks off the truck as soon as they could, as invisibly as they could. I asked my West Virginia guy to talk to the local sheriffs, to have their deputies keep their eyes open for that, for the tree trunks. But that's probably a low priority over there. We need to light some fires. Ray, you think we should wander around West Virginia looking for tree trunks? What the hell else you got to do other than watch my back? Lucas asked. It has two benefits. If they're tracking me somehow and see what we're doing, they'll try to interfere and we'll have a shot at them. If they're not tracking us, there's a fair chance we'll find the tree trunks. Then, if we wanted, we could take the whole thing public, or talk to big guys at the Department of Justice, or do something to drive Ritter and his pals out in the open. Like what? Ray asked. I haven't figured that part out yet, Lucas said. I'd like to talk to the big guys at the Department of Justice anyway, Bob said, to tell them what I think about everything. That's a real good idea, Ray said. Remind me not to be there. Bob yawned and said, Let's find a pancake place tomorrow morning and work it out. Pancakes, coffee, and West by God, Virginia. They got pancakes in D.C.? Haven't looked, but there's gotta be something. Maybe even downstairs, Lucas said. We've gotta move early, before 9. Ray, in case somebody needs to tell you, 9's not early. Say, I wonder if they got grits. Jesus, I'm not watching you eat grits or okra. Let's stick with pancakes, Lucas said. Waffles, Bob said. Big scoop of creamery butter. They got cows in D.C.? With all the bullshit that comes out of here, you'd think there'd be a cow around somewhere, Ray said. Let's talk more in the morning, Lucas said. Before he went to bed, Lucas went to his iPad and called up maps of Virginia and West Virginia. Because the mountains ran northeast to southwest, so did most of the roads. The quickest way out of the area around Smalls's cabin and back to the D.C. area was almost straight east. If they were right about the tree trunks, they would have been ditched in Hampshire County, West Virginia, or in Frederick or Shenandoah counties in Virginia. But the killers wouldn't have wanted to drive in traffic with the logs on the side of their truck. Lucas called up a satellite view of the area and made some notes on likely roads back toward I-66 into Washington, avoiding towns and traffic. He spent an hour at it, then did a search for the sheriff's contact emails in the three counties. He made up 3 emails explaining what he wanted to do, asking for help, and telling them that he'd arrive with 2 other marshals by noon. He finally put away his electronics, read the Hyacin book for a while, and went to bed at 1 o'clock. Wasn't much of a plan, he thought, before the lights went out, but it was something. The next day, they did the pancakes and waffles, sausage links, and bacon at a greasy but otherwise decent diner off in the general direction of Capitol Hill, recommended by the hotel's concierge. Lucas told Bob and Ray about the emails he'd sent to the sheriffs the night before and the follow-up calls he'd made that morning. He'd gotten some grumbling, but they agreed to meet at a country store at noon and supply a few cars to methodically cruise the ditches and side roads specified by Lucas and to search turnoffs or other likely dump spots. "And what are we going to do?" Bob asked. "Same thing. I've marked some places that I think would be good prospects, close to major roads, heavy cover, and so on," Lucas said. I didn't have time before we left, but I saved the stuff on a thumb drive, and I'll run down to the business center and print out maps before we leave. You are a paragon of efficiency, Bob said, but it sounds really, really boring. Probably, but I've also figured out a small variation on the whole plan. What's that? Ray asked. I'm going to tell these sheriffs and their deputies that the reason this is so important is we believe somebody tried to assassinate Senator Smalls and actually did murder his friend, Lucas said. That this isn't some fishing expedition looking for a minnow, and it might be something they'd like to get credit for. Ray stopped chewing on her strip of bacon. Lucas, that'll wind up in the newspapers sooner or later, or on TV. Lucas nodded. For sure, because if one of the sheriffs doesn't leak it, I will. Back at the hotel, Bob and Ray hauled their equipment bags down to their rented Tahoe. Lucas rolled out his Evoque, and at 10 o'clock, dressed in jeans, long-sleeved shirts, and boots, on a day that was already sweating heavily, with thunderheads building to the southwest, they took off for West Virginia. Included in the equipment that the two marshals had brought were radios with headsets so they wouldn't have to talk on cell phones. Lucas set the pace, and they rolled west on I-66, and at 11:50 arrived in the small town of Strasburg, Virginia. Since everyone involved was a cop, they'd agreed to rendezvous at a convenience store that also sold Dunkin' Donuts. When they arrived, the parking lot looked like a police convention, with 7 sheriff's cars scattered around the blacktop. The store wasn't big enough to hold all the cops, so they got ice cream cones and donuts and sacks of potato chips and gathered in the shade of an ash tree to talk. Lucas introduced himself, Bob, and Ray. The sheriff said that they already had deputies out looking, but without any luck at that point. Lucas said, "Look, we appreciate your help. This is important. We have developed some evidence, which I'm not allowed to talk about, that this so-called accident was an assassination attempt aimed at Senator Smalls. The killers wound up murdering an innocent woman, but we believe she was what you call collateral damage." They seemed skeptical. One deputy said, "You know how many trees we have in West Virginia? If somebody said 1 billion, I'd say that's probably low. Might be that many down tree trunks, too." Bob jumped in. "I know what you're thinking, that this sounds like some kind of federal horseshit, but I promise you it's not. We're not fancy federal cops. We're street guys. We make our living kicking down doors and kinda, you know, looking for trees. This might be the most important case we'll ever work on, and that you'll ever work on. Even if you have your doubts, I hope you'll work it hard. Ray. Lucas and Bob and I will all be out there, combing through the woods, right along with y'all. If we find what we're looking for, we'll have hard proof that this was murder." After some more back and forth, and the purchase of massive numbers of additional donuts, Cokes, Diet Cokes, a couple of Pepsis, and water, the crowd broke up, still with some grumbling. Lucas, Bob, and Ray caucused before they left, Lucas asking, "What do you think?" "They'll look," Bob said. "At least for today, maybe tomorrow. Not much longer, though. It's too goddamn hot out there." Ray touched Lucas's arm and said, "Don't get your hopes up, big guy. This is a needle in a haystack." Lucas effusively thanked all 3 sheriffs before they left, including the 2 from Virginia, but believed that the tree trunks, if they were to be found, would be in West Virginia. They wouldn't have gone far before they got rid of them. All they needed to do was get caught in somebody's headlights, and they'd be dealing with witnesses. Bob said, "They could have pulled over 1 minute after the accident, taken the trees, the lattice, whatever, taken it apart, thrown the trees in the bed of the truck, and taken them to a landfill somewhere." Lucas was shaking his head. "No. When they made the lattice, they would have wanted to protect the entire length of the truck. I looked up the F-250, their model. It's almost 21 feet long. But they've got a short bed, and the cargo box is only like 6 feet 9 inches long. If they put 21-foot logs in a 6-foot box, they'd have a 15-foot overhang. That'd be as noticeable as hanging them off the side." "Then let's go find the needle," Bob said. They started where the accident took place, looking down the steep slope at the river below. Ray said, "Think about it. The accident happens. Do they watch to make sure they go over the cliff, or do they keep going?" For one reason or another, they apparently kept going, Lucas said. Porter told me that he was afraid they'd come down the hill and finish them off, so he got a gun out of the back and hid out. Nobody came down, and he never saw the truck again or even its lights. Ray. How far would they drive before they pulled over? They'd have to be thinking that there might be a witness, so it wouldn't be in the first 2 minutes they'd actually want to, you know, get away, get out of sight. Look for places they could do that, Lucas said. Bob and Ray led, with the Tahoe's wheels edging the road, Ray hanging out the window as Bob drove. Lucas edged the wheels of the Evoque off the other side of the road, looking in the ditches for any changes in the foliage. The ditch on his side was shallow, and there were occasional ripples in the weeds, but he saw nothing that looked suspicious. The going was brutally slow and hot, and Lucas had one arm hung out the window, the better to get his head out where he could see. By the end of the day, he thought he'd be bruised from his armpit to his elbow. When they got to the main intersection leading out, they saw a sheriff's car crawling toward them. They stopped to talk, and the deputy said he'd followed the road 4 miles out, both sides of it, and had seen nothing. "There were some woodlots back there, right along the road. I got out and looked, but there were only a couple of spurs back into the trees. I didn't see anything fresh." "Nothing behind us," Lucas said. "So we go east? You're welcome to track along with us." "More trees that way," the deputy said. "We'll be taking it slow." They again took it slowly, 4 or 5 miles an hour, getting out to walk in some spots. They had 2 false alarms, but never did find anything good. But another deputy did. Her name was Marlis Weaver, and she found the logs 50 feet up a remote forest road, a place called South Branch Hills Drive, which crossed the mountains toward Virginia. Lucas took the call from the sheriff on his cell phone.
"Old Marlis says she's found them." "I personally didn't think we had a snowball's chance in hell, but Marlis always knows what she's talking about."
"How do we get there?" Lucas asked. Lucas and Bob and Ray, in their 2 trucks, followed the sheriff's deputy cross-country, the deputy playing with his lights and siren, though they rarely saw another car. Running hard on poor roads, they got to Marlis Weaver in 20 minutes. When they came up to Weaver's patrol car and saw the sheriff's car coming in from the other direction, Lucas piled out of the Evoque and joined Bob and Ray, and Bob said, "Man, we should have looked here first. If I was gonna find a spot..." They were 15 miles from the accident scene on a lightly used road that ran east up a shallow valley toward the top of the mountain ridge and down the other side. On the right side of the road, a track cut off to the south up the wall of the valley. The deputy, Weaver, was standing 100 feet up the track and 20 or 30 feet above them. She shouted, "Don't let anybody drive up! We have some tire tracks." Ray said, "No fucking way." And the sheriff came up, and Lucas, Bob, Ray, the sheriff, and the deputy who'd been working with them all walked up the middle of the track to Weaver. She was a stout young woman with short hair and glasses, dark patches of sweat at the armpits of her black and green uniform. As they left the road, she shouted again, "Watch your ankles! I might have kicked a copperhead out of there." "Oh, that's good," the sheriff muttered. He was a broad, anxious-looking man with a red face and redder nose. "Somebody else walk ahead of me." "The first walker only scares them," Ray said. "They strike at the second one in line."
"Good to know, young lady," the sheriff said. "2 of you walk in front of me."
The track had no apparent reason for its existence. It ran 100 yards up the hill and then simply petered out.
"There's an illegal dump back there. Doesn't get used too much," Weaver explained, pointing on up the hill. "I didn't see the logs when I walked up. Spotted them on the way back down. Right over here."
The track itself ran up a sloping spine, which rolled off to each side. To the west of the road, a patch of raspberries spread across the hillside. Weaver led them down a foot-wide track, and there, 15 feet into the berry patch, were 4 logs, each at least 20 feet long and 5 or 6 inches in diameter.
"Got silver car paint on them," she looked at Lucas. "You said that caddy was silver, sir?"
"That's right," Lucas said. He knelt by the logs, found scrapes of silver paint, and Bob, working beside him, said, "Look here." Lucas looked, and Bob pointed at cuts that went horizontally around the logs. "That's where they put the chains or the ropes to tie them together." Lucas looked at Weaver. "Great job, great job. You said there were tracks?"
"Yes, sir. Only fresh ones up here, and only about 1 foot long, but somebody ran right up into some softer dirt here."
She pointed, and all of them crawled out of the raspberry patch to look. The track wasn't entirely clean. Weeds grew up out of the tread marks, but they were clear enough if you looked closely. The sheriff said, "Might have been some more over here." And they found another 6 inches of similar track.
"Need to check the whole road out," the sheriff said.
"Lucas, I've got to make a phone call. Let's stay away from the logs completely and out of that raspberry patch in case they left behind some DNA. And let's try to stay away from snakes, but work that track. See if we find more treads coming or going. They must have turned around up here somewhere." Bob, Ray, and the sheriff got everybody organized as more deputies rolled in, while Lucas got on his phone and called Carl Armstrong.
"Guess where I'm at," he said when Armstrong got on the phone. "Minnesota? You went home?"
"I'm on a mountain road here in West Virginia. We found the logs with silver paint. We've got treads. We need an accident investigator."
He looked up at a growing thunderhead to the southwest.
"We need him quick in case it rains.
I'm running out the door,"
Armstrong said after Lucas told them where they were.
"But it'll be a couple of hours anyway."
Armstrong told Lucas to get to the nearest store and buy plastic sheets.
"Garbage bags, anything. The bigger, the better."
To cover the tread marks and as much of the logs as possible. Lucas told the sheriff what was needed, and one of the deputy's cars went screaming away, lights and sirens running.
"Back in 20 minutes if he doesn't kill himself," the sheriff said. "Don't think that cloud'll hit us. Looks to me like it'll slide off to the east."
The deputy got back in 30 minutes with painter's plastic drop cloths. They wrapped the logs and covered the tread marks they'd found. One of the deputies trenched around the treads to drain water away. With an extra sheet of plastic and the smell of rain in their noses, they tented the wrapped logs and anchored the plastic with sticks from the surrounding timber. Then the rain hit, a downpour that would have given Noah a hard time. They sat in their cars, running the air conditioning and listening to music, flinching at the nearby thunder and the lightning that flickered through the woods. The rain lasted 20 minutes and rolled off to the northeast. The sheriff, getting out of his car into the last bit of drizzle, said,
"Like I told you, it was sliding off to the east."
"Too bad it wasn't a direct hit," Ray said.
"Might have drowned the fucking snakes."
Armstrong took a bit longer than 2 hours to arrive. Lucas impatiently paced the road, calling him twice to make sure he hadn't killed himself. Eventually, Lucas, Ray, Bob, and the sheriff went out to a country store that sold microwave bean burritos, the same store where the deputy had bought the drop cloths, and had a nasty lunch.
"You still gonna talk to the newspapers?" Ray asked.
She kept her voice down, and Bob had moved in to block the sheriff out of the quiet conversation. He was having a noisy campaign chat with the store owners anyway.
"I've got to talk to Porter's top aide. She's in on this, and she probably has a link to somebody I could call.
I'm thinking we should drop a hint anonymously at one of the major news stations and maybe the Washington Post and give them the sheriff's name. He's a talkative sort, Lucas said, glancing over at him. I don't want it out there before we've got an eye on that truck, though.
Day after tomorrow would be soon enough, Bob said. Lucas nodded. I'll work it out this evening after Armstrong shows up.
Armstrong arrived in a pickup with two crime scene investigators. The sky had cleared, and the three men carefully peeled the plastic off the logs. Armstrong looked at the paint scrapings, comparing them to a piece of metal taken from Smalls' Cadillac. After a moment, he muttered something to himself, stood up, and walked over to Lucas, Bob, and Ray.
If that paint didn't come off the caddy, I'll eat the logs.
We need to take paint samples and transport the logs. You said there were some tracks that might be associated?
They showed him the tracks, and the two CSI guys went to work with lights, cameras, and tape measures, eventually clipping the vegetation in the tread marks and making casts with a beige-colored liquid that quickly solidified. As the sun dropped toward the horizon, the logs were wrapped in plastic padding and loaded one by one onto the pickup and tied down, with red flags hanging from the exposed ends sticking out of the back of the truck. Armstrong asked Lucas,
"What about the truck? When can I look at it?"
"Day after tomorrow, probably," Lucas said. "We've got some prep work to do."
"So do I," Armstrong said. "I need to measure the logs and see what kind of impact marks they'd leave on an F-250 if they were used the way we think they were, although they were probably well padded. The formal lab results on the paint will take a while, and we need to go over the logs inch by inch to see if there's even a speck of black paint."
"When we decide to officially look at the truck, we'll call," Lucas said. That night, Lucas walked over to Kit and Carter's apartment complex and took an elevator to the fourth floor. She was standing in the hallway and waved at him when he stepped off the elevator. Carter lived in a two-bedroom unit, with the second bedroom converted into a compact, messy office with a desk and two visitors' chairs. Lucas saw the office as he walked by, but Carter pointed him into the living room and asked him if he'd like a glass of wine or a bottle of water. He took water, and she asked if he wanted bubbly or still, and he took bubbly. When they finally sat down to talk, he told her about finding the truck.
"Then we've got something? What do we have?"
"We've got one end of the string," Lucas said. "If we find black paint on the logs, we could pick up Ritter. But I don't think they'll find any. I've looked at that truck, and I didn't see a single scrape or mark of any kind. So we get Armstrong over here to go over the truck. We roust Ritter, but we don't take him yet. Let's see if we can create some cracks in their team."
"How?"
"Do you know anybody at the Post or one of the major TV stations who you could talk to off the record, who would never give you up?" She nodded.
"Yes, of course. I can always feed them a tip, if you can tell me what to say."
"I need you to give them the names of a couple of people. Russell Fort over at the Marshals Service, and the sheriff we worked with, and Carl Armstrong in West Virginia. None of them might give much up, but if you give a good reporter a few details, he'll be able to pry a few more facts out into the open, especially if he talks to the sheriff."
"Give me the details, in 1 minute."
She got off the couch and went into her office and came back with a legal pad.
"Okay, I want to make sure I get this right."
Investigators from the Marshals Service found four logs with paint on them that matched the paint from Senator Smalls' Cadillac. That's now being confirmed in a crime scene lab. He gave her the name of the sheriff and the deputy who found the logs and Fort's name and phone number. He added, Marshals Service investigators have reported to their superiors that they have a lead on the truck based on video taken the day before the murder and assassination attempt. When should I feed it to them?
Depends on who you're going to give it to, Lucas said. Depends on when you want it out. I can give it to a friend at WJZ and have it on the air tomorrow night, or to a woman at the post who'd put it up the next morning. Or both.
Let's go with both, Lucas said. We don't want them to miss it. Make sure you're totally off the record.
What are you going to do?
We're going to look for reaction. We're going to hope for one. The next day wasn't quite a waste. Ritter's truck remained parked at his apartment with the empty space next to it. Lucas did see Ritter arriving back at his apartment at 5:15 in the afternoon, driving a sporty red Mazda Miata. He left again at 7 o'clock and drove a mile or so to a cocktail lounge called the Wily Rat, with Lucas following behind, and with Bob, who'd been about to take over the watch from Lucas, trailing in the Tahoe. Ritter parked and walked toward the nightclub's entrance. Before he got there, a short, slender woman came out, looked both ways down the sidewalk, and spotted Ritter walking toward her. She trotted over to him, put her hands on his shoulders, jumped up and wrapped her legs around his waist. Ritter kissed her, and they spoke for a minute. Then she jumped down, and they walked into the club. Bob followed them inside a few minutes later, got a beer, watched for a while, walked back outside, and told Lucas, who was waiting in the parking lot, "They're getting burgers and beers. Met some people in there, looked like military folks. Yakking it up."
"Not much, then."
"Not yet. My turn to watch them. Do you want me to follow them home?"
"Be nice to know who the woman is," Lucas said.
"I'll see if I can spot her car, get her plates."
"Okay," Lucas yawned.
"I'm going back to the hotel. Kitten said there'll be something on TV tonight about the assassination attempt, so you might see something from Ritter. If anything happens, call. Gonna get up early. We should see something in the papers tomorrow for sure, and all over TV."
11. Taryn Grant didn't see the original broadcast about the assassination attempt on Porter Smalls, but her chief of staff picked up an echo on CNN. Mabel Tate was at first bemused with the report, which was more than a little vague. Then, recalling the controversy surrounding her boss's initial election, and with the news report's reminder that a woman had been killed, bemusement shifted to concern, and she called Grant at home. Grant did not like to be called at home with anything less than end-of-the-world problems. She had a date that night with an Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, Legislative Affairs, who was on temporary career-building loan to the Treasury from J.P. Morgan Chase. She hoped to impress him with the plight of hapless billionaires facing unfair tax burdens. He was a sleaze, she knew, the kind of government official who owned a specialized high-riding electric razor that kept him in permanent 3-day beard mode, and who wore custom silk dress shirts open at the throat to show off the mat of chest hair beneath. But he had his uses. Grant definitely favored men who had uses. When her phone rang, she picked it up, saw Tate on the screen, and asked, "What?"
"Have you been watching the news?" Tate asked. "Are we bombing somebody?"
"I wouldn't call you for that," Tate said. "This might be worse." Grant knew Tate wouldn't call for anything trivial. She had a dressing stool in the bathroom, and she sat and said, "Tell me."
"There are reports on CNN that a U.S. Marshal is claiming that Porter Smalls' accident last week wasn't an accident, that it was an assassination attempt," Tate said.
There's no comment from the marshal, but there's a comment from a West Virginia sheriff who said the marshal and he and his deputies found some logs with silver automotive paint on them, which had been hung off the side of the truck that forced Smalls's car off the road. They say the truck has been spotted on video, a black Ford F-250. The logs were apparently an attempt to make it look like Smalls's truck hit nothing but trees. CNN says that Smalls is traveling to the CNN affiliate in Minneapolis to be interviewed later in the show, and that the truck is being sought. Shit. I didn't need to hear this. I'm sorry. No, I mean I didn't need to have this happen. But you did right to call, Grant said. The problem is it could dredge up all that old crap around the election. The marshal is named Lucas Davenport. Was he mentioned? Was he on the show? He's definitely out to get me. No, they didn't mention his name. They called somebody at the Marshal's Service headquarters who had no comment. A spokesman for the Justice Department said the matter is being reviewed at the highest levels, which means they don't have a clue. Since it's Smalls and a woman is dead, and even worse, she's a rich woman who gave lots of money to Republicans, I imagine there'll be a lot said tomorrow. God damn it! Listen, monitor this for me, all the channels, and call me at 11 o'clock. I've got a date, but I should be home before then. And if it's urgent, call me any time, Grant said. If you have to bring a couple of people in, go ahead. I'd like to see some transcripts of the major shows. We can do it. Because of the controversy, what should I do if they start looking for a comment from you? I'm not available. I have no knowledge of the incident. If you can, go deep off the record with reporters you can trust and suggest that Smalls has a history of alcoholism that he has successfully covered up. This might be part of another cover-up. If he was drunk when the woman was killed and he was driving, that would make him guilty of vehicular homicide. Do you think he was? Tate asked. I don't know and I don't care, Grant said. I know that he does drink a bit. I've seen him tipsy. The point is to fuzz things up. You got it, Tate said. When Tate was off the phone, Grant went back to her mirror for a minute, working on her eyelashes, thinking about the news reports, and when she was done with the mascara, dabbed on touches of black orchid perfume and called Parrish. He hadn't seen the news either. When she told him about it, he said, "Give me some time to check around. I'll handle this personally. No blowbacks." "I said it before. It's Davenport we have to worry about. If he goes away somehow, we're in much better shape." "I'm handling Davenport. It's already underway." If the Treasury man thought he was going to get laid by a beautiful blonde Minnesota senator, he was mistaken. He made some of the usual eye and touching moves that men thought were good ideas when dealing with desirable women, but Grant, as a long-legged blonde and one of the heirs to a multi-billion-dollar fortune, had been inoculated against that kind of bullshit from the time she was 8. Still, the night developed profitably for the both of them. When the Treasury guy realized that Grant was looking for an insider, not a piece of his ass, he slid into negotiating mode, and they spent their time over cocktails and cocktail napkins, where they outlined possible beneficial changes to the tax law. Not really fun, but not uninteresting either. They'd finished dinner and were drinking the last of a $400 bottle of white Bordeaux when Grant's cell phone buzzed. Tate. "I've got to take this," she said. She turned away from the Treasury guy and said, "Yes?" "An update. Smalls had a press conference. Every TV station in the Twin Cities was there. Parts of it will hit the major networks and Fox and CNN. He didn't mention any names, but he said that violence had been used against him before and that he wouldn't let it shake him. 3 different reporters tried to get him to say your name. They mentioned you, asked if that was what he was talking about. He smiled. Might as well have said your name. He never did, but everybody got the point." God damn it. I'm going to have to say something. Work it for me. Remember what I said about seeing him tipsy, drunk? See if you can work that in. If he's going to get in my face, I'll get right back in his. I'll get some ideas together, but it might not be the wisest move. There are other ways to get in his face. Give me those, too.
She went back to the treasury man with a smile. Porter Smalls is getting in my face about his drunken accident last week. If you want to witness a traumatic castration, watch me on the news tomorrow. He laughed and said, I believe you ahead of time, and I'll be watching. Grant was home at 11 when Tate called again. Talk to my guy at PBS, they're sucking wind on the story, and they liked that thing about Smalls's drinking problem and the questions that might raise. I don't know if it'll do us a lot of good, but it will fuzz things up, like you said. I've also got them checking up on this Davenport's record. He sounds like a trigger-happy right-winger. He's killed a whole bunch of people. I don't want to mess with a nice storyline, but Davenport actually worked for Elmer Henderson. Henderson was temporarily out of office, but had been the governor of Minnesota and the extremely liberal Democratic vice presidential candidate in the previous election. Oh, well, basically, who gives a shit? Tate said. We can still frame him as an attention-seeking killer. That should create more fuzz. I knew there was a good reason I hired you, Grant said. Keep thinking about this. The more fuzz, the better. See you in the morning. I'll be making a statement. She was tired, but checked with Parrish. Still working on Davenport? We need to talk. Ritter got back to me a couple of hours ago. We've done some work. Are you at your house? Yes. Come over. We'll talk. Give me 20 minutes, Parrish said. I'll come on foot. Parrish showed up, dressed all in black nylon, with a black and green camouflage baseball cap and running shoes. He looked like a crow, Grant thought, as he came down the basement stairs. The housekeeper had let him in, and Grant watched the computer pad that showed the door sealed at the top of the stairs, and that Parrish was carrying a gun. He dropped onto the sofa opposite her desk, and she could suddenly smell him. He jogged over. What have you got? She asked. I've had Jim Ritter in St. Paul the last 2 days doing observations. We've found a situation that may work for us and that will take Davenport out of Washington. If he's as bright as you say, he might suspect something, but he'd never be sure. The longer he's out of Washington, the colder the whole situation becomes. 2 weeks, and it's cool. A month from now, nobody'll care. Exactly. We needed to find a particular guy in St. Paul or Minneapolis, and we found him. Parrish outlined what he had in mind, and Grant closed her eyes as she listened, the better to visualize Parrish's proposal. If there are cops too close, she said when he was done, there won't be. We'll be tracking them. Tracking them passively, listening only, not talking to anyone. All we need is 10 seconds, 15 at the outside. If the cops are too close, we reset. 15 seconds, as long as your man doesn't get hurt. If he gets hurt, we're in trouble, Grant said. Handled. Handled how? Parrish laughed. Well, the man we found is a fat guy. Ritter's coat will be stuffed with bubble wrap, and, of course, he'll be braced. He's done this before, actually, when they were trying to take down a guy without it being an obvious hit. Grant sat back in her chair and thought it over. Parrish's operators, supposedly the creme of American hitmen, had already screwed up twice. On the other hand, she had to get Davenport out of her business. If they knew the truck that hit Smalls's vehicle was a Ford F-250, she didn't doubt that he would eventually find it.
All right, she said. Let's do it. No fuck-ups. No fuck-ups.
Grant went to sleep easily enough, unaffected by any anticipatory guilt, though she grew restless at 6 in the morning, an hour before she usually got up. There was one thing that hadn't occurred to her the night before, and that Parrish hadn't considered. What if Davenport decided Grant was responsible for it all, and he simply killed her? He could probably do it without being caught. And he was crazy, wasn't he? As crazy as she was? She shuddered, tried to go back to sleep, but couldn't get it out of her mind. Tate called at 7 as Grant was downing a double espresso. "You've got the Senate studio from 8:30 to 9:15. I'm rounding up the usual suspects from the local media and as many national people as I can find. We need to talk before you go on. You should wear your best TV stuff." "Already there. Call Allison about hair and makeup." "Done. You okay?" "I'm fine," Grant said. "This will work for us."
12.
Bob and Ray called early, waking Lucas, to tell him that they were going to work out before starting the day. Bob added that the girlfriend had gone back to Ritter's apartment in his car, so he hadn't been able to get a license plate number on her. Lucas took his time shaving, didn't bother to look at the television, and went down to the restaurant for breakfast. He was finishing his pancakes when he heard a man in a $2,000 suit ask a woman in a $2,000 dress, "Did you see her? Hot blonde senator with a severe case of the red ass?"
"I did," the woman said. "The shit has hit the proverbial fan. I like it."
Survivalists fantasize about SHTF Day, when shit hits the fan. Mexico invades Arizona, the gasoline runs out, all the chickens get eaten, and anybody who doesn't have a root cellar in the backyard fully stocked with AR-15s, camouflage hats, hunting bows, and gold coins is doomed to a life of sexual slavery or death by cannibalism. So far, that day hadn't happened, except in the media. There, it happened about once a week, with the intellects at Fox and CNN howling about breaking news, as if the real SHTF day had finally arrived. When the rich guy asked the rich woman about a blonde senator, Lucas felt an eyebrow rise almost of its own accord. He'd been reading the Washington Post as he ate. There'd been a short, ambiguous article about sources saying that the Marshals Service was investigating the Smalls auto accident as a possible assassination attempt. Most of the story was simply recounting the accident with not much on later developments. But if Grant had jumped into it, that would raise more eyebrows than his. He waved at the waitress, got the bill, left money on the table, and while he didn't trot to the elevators, he wasted no time getting back to his room. Both CNN and Fox had already gotten past the actual news and were asking their talking heads to opine on what the senators were saying about each other. Lucas went to his laptop, entered Taryn Grant in the Bing search window, and got back a half dozen hits. He found a replay available on C-SPAN and watched as Taryn Grant ripped a new one for Porter Smalls. Lucas got on the phone to Smalls. "Have you seen Grant?"
"No. Has she said something? Anything she says will hurt her. Did you see me on CCO last night?"
"No, I didn't know you were on. What did you say?"
"Look for it. It's all over the place," Smalls said.
"Just tell me, Senator."
Smalls cleared his throat and said,
"Well, I had some news media call me up and tell me that these tree trunks had been found by a U.S. Marshal and had silver paint on them.
I assumed the marshal was you. Yeah, me and two other marshals, and a West Virginia sheriff and some deputies.
Good, good. Lots of witnesses. Anyway, I started getting more calls, and then CNN and a Washington TV station asked me to go down to CCO and make a statement for them.
Did you say Taryn Grant was involved?
No, not by name. I did say that I'd experienced this kind of thing in the past, although that was character assassination, and this was real assassination, a dear friend being murdered. It didn't take a genius to put two and two together, which is a good thing, because geniuses are a little thin on the ground in the TV media these days. Anyway, the reporters started asking me if I was accusing Taryn Grant of trying to assassinate me. I told them that it was clear that somebody was trying to assassinate me, but I had no idea who it was. They kept trying to get me to say Grant did it, and I kept tap dancing.
But you never said it wasn't Grant.
Of course not, Small said, because it is.
Lucas said, well, she just went on TV here and said that you're senile and that everybody in the Senate knows it, that you were probably drunk when the accident took place because you're also quite well known as a secret alcoholic, that you may well be guilty of vehicular homicide if you were driving drunk, and that you'd sent your pet marshal to try to frame her and she wasn't going to stand for it.
Long pause.
She didn't say that, Smalls finally said.
Not really. Look at a C-SPAN rerun.
Sounds like one heck of a guilty overreaction to me, Smalls said.
Given the context, that's not what the news analysts are saying, Lucas said. He was looking at CNN.
They're saying that you did everything but flatly accuse her of trying to kill you. How would she overreact to that?
I can't say I'm sorry, Small said. It's out in the open now. Let's see what happens.
As the pet marshal, I wouldn't be surprised if I got fired, Lucas said.
I would, Small said. Try to remember which party is in the majority now. I wouldn't be surprised if the tweeter-in-chief wades into it.
Oh, shit.
Keep pushing, Lucas. You're doing good. If you or anyone at the Marshal's Service needs help, call me.
Lucas called Russell Fort, and as he finished dialing, he heard a knock at the door. He walked across the room, took the spitball from the peephole, looked out, and saw Ray's face. He opened the door, waved Bob and Ray inside. They were still dressed in their workout clothes. And when Fort answered the phone, Lucas asked him, "Have you seen Grant?"
"Everybody's seen Grant," Fort said. "The shit has hit the fan."
"That seems to be the general opinion," Lucas said. "Are we in trouble?"
"Hard to tell," Fort said. "I've got lines out. There's a rumor that the FBI might want to talk to us."
"Kick us out? Take over the investigation?"
"That'd be all right with me."
I don't think so. This is becoming the hottest potato in Washington, and you don't often see the FBI stepping up to intercept hot potatoes. I've gotten a call from the director's assistant, our director, not the FBI's, and I'll be talking with him later this morning.
What should we do here? We were planning to call you about a search warrant for this afternoon.
Hold off on that, Fort said. Let's see what the director has to say, see if anybody else gets into it. I'm sure the director will be talking with the attorney general. Let's see what happens.
You're telling me to lay low.
For a few hours. Go climb the Washington Monument or something. Be a tourist.
All right. Smalls told me if you need some support to call him.
If I need it, I'll call you to call him, Fort said. I'd rather not talk to him directly at this point. Not being a director.
Lucas filled in Bob and Ray.
It's not bad, he said. It's a bureaucratic clusterfuck, but it has the effect of chasing these people out in the open.
There's no way Grant or Parrish will do anything now, Ray said.
We couldn't count on them doing anything before, Lucas said. They're operating through Ritter and Heracles. Once all of the news people start talking about Whitehead being murdered, maybe we'll get a little panic. We could use a little panic.
So what are we going to do? Bob asked.
Nothing. Spend a day or two as tourists and let the situation cook, as Fort had suggested. Keep an eye on the news. They tried to do that, but failed. While Lucas went for a walk around the Capitol and to look at the White House, Ray went to the National Gallery and Bob went to find an uncle's name on the Vietnam Memorial. But by 1 o'clock they were back in Lucas's room watching sporadic commentary on the news channels, and a few minutes after that, Gladys Ingram, the lawyer, called Lucas.
I'm going to email you a bunch of links. You said this phone was safe?
About as safe as it gets, but, you know.
I'm going to give you a string of numbers. You'll need to write them down.
Lucas got his pen and a legal pad. Ingram gave him 18 random numbers.
That string will open the email I sent to you. If you copy the email with a pen, it's quite short, but you'll have to be accurate, you can touch the burn tab, and the email will eat itself. I don't think, even if they're listening to us, they could interfere, but if you save the documents instead of burning them, they might be able to get at them later. So print out a paper copy and hold it close.
I'll do it right now. He did. There were 12 links, and they provided the same information that Kid had, but now flowing from a different source. Lucas copied the 12 out on paper, then burned the email. If any investigator ever asked how he'd come up with all those links, he had an answer. At 2, Fort called and said, "Me, my boss, you met him, Gabe O'Connor, and a few high-level suits from the FBI want to talk to you."
"Where at?"
"Conference room at the FBI building. They'll take you to the conference room when you show up at 4 o'clock sharp. Bring Bob and Ray."
"Gonna be trouble?"
"Doesn't feel like it. More like an ass-covering mission."
Lucas told Bob and Ray that they'd been summoned, and they spent half an hour speculating about what would happen. And, despite the heat and the suffocating humidity, they decided to walk the 2 miles to the meeting.
"We need to look professional," Bob objected. "If we walk, we'll be all sweaty when we get there."
Ray shrugged.
"But it'll sort of let them know we're not too worried about things. They get all the media, but we're just as big a deal as they are, sort of."
"So you're saying we should push them back with offensive body odor?" Bob asked.
"Walk?" Ray asked Lucas. "Or drive, and spend an hour trying to find a parking place?"
"Walk," Lucas said.
They started walking by 3 o'clock, stopped on the way to get Cokes, paused at an au bon pain across the street from the FBI to cool off, and arrived at the building looking crisp and non-sweaty, although they might not have passed a sniff test.
"Goddamn building looks like it was built by fucking Joseph Stalin," Bob grumbled, looking up at the Hoover building as they crossed the street.
"Art history-wise, I would say you're correct," Ray said.
Inside, they found Fort and O'Connor waiting in the lobby with an FBI gopher who escorted them to an elevator, up a few floors and 50 yards down a hallway to a conference room. Other than the 5 of them and the usual table and chairs, the room was empty.
"Everybody likes to be last, because that way we know who's most important," O'Connor said.
He was a beefy man, in a pale blue suit and white shirt, carrying an old-style leather briefcase. He took a sheaf of papers from the case and said,
"I understand you guys may be asking for a search warrant."
"Depending on how this comes out," Lucas said.
"I can tell you that in advance. You're to be cautiously aggressive, or aggressively cautious.
I've been told that the FBI is not anxious to get involved until they figure out who's the fall guy. There are several possibilities, including you three.
Great, Ray said. The thing is, if you pull this off and prove there was an assassination attempt, it'll be a big feather in our cap. If you screw it up, then...
O'Connor was about to go on, but the door popped open and a half-dozen suits walked in. 3 men, 3 women, and everybody shook hands.